Good morning. Shall we get started? So I'm Sergio. I'm a graduate student co-instructing. I'm honored to co-instruct this class this semester and hopefully helping Charles. And I have to say you are quite an amazing audience. So I'll do my best. I'll try to cover the subject super well. I'm from Romania myself, and in Romania we have a word to basically the level of understanding is when it becomes part of who you are. So I'm trying to get there. And I think we are all trying. So let's get there together. Now let's try to make this content part of who we are. So today we're going to go a bit through the last part of assembly, and we're going to look at how files get compiled into binaries, how C files, source files, are compiled into binaries, and then we'll talk a bit about C, several aspects of C. So in the last lecture, we looked at LEA, we talked about this load effective address instruction. So what it does it really do is it computes the address. So the processor has logic dedicated to compute address, and it's arithmetic logic. And then the processor doesn't really check, is that address, does it exist? Is it a valid address in the system, or a hardware address? So we saw how we can use that resource, that logic resource, to actually do arithmetics faster than we would use, you know, the dedicated arithmetic operations. Then we looked at condition codes. So those were those flags. So when we do arithmetics operations, the flags, such as zero flag, ZF, sign flag, SF, they get updated at every arithmetic operation. It's just part of the implementation. So zero flag, where's the arithmetic operation? Result zero. Sign flag, was the result negative? Overflow, was there an overflow? Carry flag, was there a carry? And then the compare operations, they look at these flags. Well, a compare operation itself is a subtraction from last argument to first. You have a subtraction, and then it's a comparison with zero. And specifically, it looks at these flags. So then the jump, not equal, jump equal, jump less, greater than equal, those are also named after comparing with zero. And we looked at converting control flow to assembly. So we specifically looked at if statement in C is converted to assembly. And today we're going to continue with the while and the switch controls. But before we do that, let's have a look at the quiz. How did you enjoy the quiz? Were there troubles? I know there were troubles. So So for the first question, it looks like the results are pretty good, right? Is it visible?
It's visible, right?
So the correct results are A and C, 80 and 82% got it right. So I think that's pretty good. And then, so we don't really need to do B and D. I don't know why that was. So why would, when we run this instruction, we just pop Q racks, right? So we have to fetch the instruction code and then execute it. I don't think we need to do within the value of the stack pointer or write that A plus. For this next one, I believe the answers were, so the mean is 0.95, so I think we should discuss this this instruction. Let's start with how P is declared, and I'm going to use the annotate here. So int P, int P is located at this address here, and that address starts over there, and we know that we are in little endian, so it's going to take four values, right? And this is the least significant bit because, so the lower address is the least significant bit, the higher address is the most significant bit. So this is the least significant bit, and then this is the most significant bit. So the value at pointer P will be 0000001008. Correct? And this is an address because this is a pointer. So then we have to go to this address right there. And what is the value in memory at that address? So again, it will be, so the most significant will start from here. So we'll have a 0009101000. And that is, I believe, the value that goes into X. So X receives the value that is at the address where P points to. That is what this statement does, right? And that will have to go at the address of X, which is over there. But that's not asking the question. So that goes into this address here. Questions about this? You don't look convinced.
So why do you add up like the parts of the address? Is it like is it because it's a pointer?
Yes. And an int takes 4 bytes. So an int will be taking 4 addresses. Is the pointer 8 bytes? So it's an int pointer. So P is declared as int P. So the pointer will also be 4. An address is usually 8 bytes, but I think in this question we are meant to take. To assume that we're going to just have 4 bytes in the. Even the other bytes are 0?
Yeah.
All right, that's also that is also the case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that is also the case. That the other bytes are also coming to zero. So, yeah. So I will do this, and I will go to the next. And then question three was, there was an error, so we're gonna accept no answer or the B and C as correct. There was a slight typo in the question itself. This was supposed to be J here, this was supposed to be I there. And then it actually does that. Would you like me to discuss this question to go into A and C, why those are not, A and D, why those are not the case? So here at A, we have load effective address, and this computes the address RAX plus RA. It stores it in the R10 register, and then we take only one byte of that register, which is an address, and we overwrite in memory that location. So we write an address on top of the value in memory, which is not what we want to do. And then at D, we offset by 8, which is, so we have RAX plus R8 times 8, which is also not what this problem does, right? We don't have plus 8 there. Times 8, we don't have that in there. So that is also different. And then for question four, 73% got it right. The way I will argue about this is there is a subtract. So this first four don't have that, so they're not correct, those A to D. And then all of these are similar in this aspect here and in this aspect here. So definitely it's all about the condition, the comparison. And so we have a comparison, which does what? It does RDX minus RCX. That's what it does. And then is that jump lower, jump less, so if it's less, then it skips, it goes to latter. Therefore, if it will be larger or equal, it will not skip, so it will actually do the addition, which is what happens in here, larger or equal. And I believe here everybody answered correct, 84%, and this was mostly a look up in the slide. You look confused. Do you have a question?
No.
All right. Not that I want to put you on the spot. So let's start with while to assembly, how we convert a while to an assembly. So here we have a while x greater or equal than zero, we enter the loop, we execute a function, and we decrement. Yes, we decrement, and when we reach zero, we are, not greater or equal to zero. We are less than zero. So let's rewrite this in a C form that uses goto's, which is more one to one with the assembly. So instead of greater or equal, I switched to less than zero. So the loop starts, if x is smaller than zero, then we skip, we go to the end of the loop, otherwise we execute the loop, and we go back to the beginning. So this is going back to the beginning, over there. Okay, now how do we map that to assembly? So we do basically a one-to-one. start loop, this will just be that, and end loop, similarly, this will be that. Then if x smaller than 0, so we compare R12 with 0, so smaller, jump is lower, to end loop, go to end loop, there is this jump here, goes over there. Otherwise we call foo, and we subtract R12 minus 1, so we decrement R12 by 1, and we jump to the beginning of the loop. Questions about this assembly? Awesome. Okay. Now, there are ways we can optimize. And if you compile with GCC, you can actually give a flag like dash O1 or O2 or O3, and that will be the level of optimization, how much optimization is done. So here we have a while loop, while b is smaller than 10, we enter the loop, we run foo, we increment b by 1, when b is higher, when b is 11, we're just going to have to, actually when b is 10, we're going to have to exit loop. So a one-to-one implementation is right here on the left. We compare rbx with 10, jump when greater or equal, so here is smaller, we swap it to greater or equal, we jump to the end, so we don't take, otherwise it's smaller, so we actually take the loop, call foo, and increment rbx, and go back to the beginning of the loop. So that's the pretty straightforward implementation of that one. Questions about this? Next, we're going to attempt to optimize that implementation on the left. So one way we can try to do that, so notice we have jump greater or equal, and then jump without a condition. So perhaps we can merge those two. Perhaps we can merge those two. So let's try to merge the jump greater or equal and the jump, these two here. So by the way, here we have how many? We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We have 5 steps in the loop. We have 5 instructions in the loop. So how do we do that here? We begin with a little prefix, but it's a fixed call. It's outside the loop. So we compare our b with 10. If it's greater than 10, then we skip. We go to the loop. We go to the end of the loop. Otherwise, we call foo, we increment, and we do the comparison. But now we are going to use jump, not equal. I also put that comment. Jump, not equal. So this still works, right? We didn't really break anything. This still works. And by the way, in the loop now we have 1, 2, 3, and 4. So we save one instruction. We go back to the loop, the beginning, we keep looping, and then when it is equal, we are just not going to go back. We're not going to jump, we're going to go to the end loop. So it works. Questions about this optimization? And last, and this one is, all the way optimized, so it looks more complicated. And it adds an even longer prefix, and even a suffix, I'll mention that. So it may be not worth it when we only have to run a few times, but it's probably very much worth it when there's a lot of loops to run. So we start the same way. We compare that we're in the right spot. And our loop is actually right here. We only have 1, 2, and 3. This is a way we turn it around. So we move a 10 in a register racks, then we do a 10 minus b, and we know that b is smaller than 10 because you know we actually we compare it already. So we do 10 minus b, and then that result we put it in b. So b becomes now 10 minus b, and now we know how much we need to decrement. So we're going to be decrementing to zero. So first we did that comparison, then we did some logistical work, right? And then we call foo, which is that. We decrement, so we don't really do plus one, we do minus one. So we're gonna have to take care of that. And jump not equal. And this decrement, you know, it will, if it reaches zero, then this will be jump equal, and we have to go to the end of the loop. And the last, before when we exit the loop, we actually update back this b. And b at the end would have the value 10. So we want to make sure that we give it that value 10. So we used b kind of in a wrong way. We made it go down, so we almost changed the behavior of b. But then we make sure that at the end, b gets the value 10. So that's, you know, we went from 5 to 4, and now to 3 instructions in the loop. So the while loop is now only 3 instructions.
Yeah. When we optimize, is it always just reducing the number of instructions, or could it also be like trying to reduce the number of times we need to access memory instead of the register?
Yeah, everything, yeah. And I would say even the size of the instruction, everything. Yeah, so when we optimize, we don't only reduce number of instructions. That was the question. We try to reduce everything. Access to memory, cache misses, and so on. Yes, please.
Do you mind repeating why you don't consider the instruction as part of a
line? So why the question is why move Q, that this line right here is not part of the loop. So the loop starts here, start loop. We call foo, we decrement b, and then we jump back to the beginning of the loop. And you know, then we repeat foo, decrement, jump, foo, decrement, jump. And when b reaches zero, that's when we don't jump. We only go one time through that move queue. Okay? Yeah, it's not part of the loop. Of course. Any other questions about this optimization process? Okay. Let's switch to switches. So a switch can be quite long, and you know, we have case one, some code, case two, some code, and then a default, and how do we implement that? How is that implemented? What are the options for us to implement that efficiently in assembly and then in machine code? So the trivial, the most intuitive option is to have like if, else, if, and if, and basically if statements, right? Racks equals to 1, and so on. You know, if racks equals to 2, if racks equals to 3, and execute that code. And so this is the one problem with this is that it has to do a lot of comparisons. If A is 10,000, then we have to go from 1 all the way to 10,000. We have to do 10,000 comparisons. So it's, you know, not efficient, right? But if you only have a small switch, it's great. Small operand size, and if you only have 4 cases, then this is great. And then a way to optimize this to make it faster is to have a binary search. So this the same way as we had that if, except now we're gonna compare. We're going to say, oh, there are 100 cases. We know how many there are. The first and the last, we know how many cases there are. And then we can do a binary search for our A. And we're going to start at the middle, at 50. We're going to do that comparison, jump less code for less than 50, so we jump over there, and then we look at 25, compare Rex with 25, and eventually we're gonna find our value. And instead of taking O of n, it's gonna take O of log n. So we're faster, we're more efficient, let's say. We reach our value faster, we don't have to go 10,000 times, in this case 100 times, we go much faster, log n. Log of 100. Questions about this, and we're about the previous one, about just switch or binary search with the switch? Okay, and the next two are somewhat more complicated, but you know, I don't think you'll have trouble. So another option is let's use the memory. Let's use, let's make a table. Let's store every single value in a table. So we're gonna first make sure. So this first two are kind of like a prefix. First, we compare if we are not above 100, so if it's not like 101, and we go to default, so that's case of default. And here, compare if we are not under 1, so if we're not, you know, here, 0. And again, it goes to default. And then this is our logic here. This is the most important part. So we jump to, and then we compute this address. It's and table minus 8 that goes together. That's the displacement. And we have this minus 8 because we start from 1. So 0 would be just table and then 1. The next slide shows it better. And then how is address computed? We have this displacement added to the racks multiplied by that. In the table we would have in the addresses, the addresses in the table would point to where the code for 1, code for 2, and so on are located. And let's see this a bit more in detail on this slide right here. So we've seen this statement on the previous slide, jump, and then the displacement, table minus 8, and then how the address gets computed. So here is our addresses, right here, addresses, and here the value for the addresses. So in the beginning, our table is located at this address here, 12500, which is right there. And let's assume that our input is this 2, racks 2. Okay. So computing the address, we're gonna have table minus 8, so that will move us one position there, and then plus racks times 8, which is 2 times 8, which is 10. So we're gonna move now over there. So this will be our result. This is the address of this case, of case 2. And this address is right there. And it points to the machine code for the case 2. Are there questions about this? This is a bit confusing. So we have a table with addresses and values in the values for the code at those addresses. And we just compute with one formula, with like a fixed formula. Yeah.
Why do we need to minus 8 in the display?
Yeah. It's because, so we kind of choose it to do that. You see the case statement starts at 1. So we want 1 to be right here. We want this to be 1 and this to be 2. So we want this to be 1 and this to be 2. So that is why. Thank you. Does that answer your question? Why?
Yeah.
So why we are adding that 8? The table starts, the cases start with 1, so we want that initial value of the table to be 1 and 0. It just happens to work like that. If you look now. All right. Now, can we do better? Why do we have to read the values from the table? So first we have to actually store those values. So these values here, we have to actually, this value has to be right there, and we have to compute it. Maybe we can just use a pointer. No? So that's another option. And the way we refer to that is computed jumps. So the idea is to use pointers instead of values from memory. And you know, the beginning part, the first four lines is the same. We first compute whether we are above 100 or below 1, and we jump to default. And then we have, instead of that address computation we had previously, we just have this statement here. So we jump to the table at rex times 8. And then we need to make sure that the code for the function that will be, we're jumping for each case, has to be in that address. So we don't have to read a value and then actually jump. We just have to, we just jump immediately. I think this is actually gonna be faster. So less memory access. Yeah. Do you have questions about this? Yeah. So Rax is the input. So what is incremented Rax? That was the question. Rax is the input to the case state, right? To the switch. Looking back at the switch, Rax is this A, switch A. That is Rax. So we don't increment it, but why? It's an input, and if we multiply it by A, so we always get the address accordingly. Questions more? Yes, please.
What's the difference between like that table label, like what was there in this method
versus the previous? Difference between this, right, the compiling switches, so this one and the computer jumps, is that a question? Huge difference, right? So here we compute an address and then we jump to the address that is in the, that is, so we compute an address, we compute an address, this one, and then at that address there is a value, and then we jump at that, at the value that is at that address. Go ahead. They are the same. it is true that in the end it is the same. And here, to me it looks like here we simply jump immediately to the address.
Okay.
Was that
it's
still a table. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't understand. So it actually makes sense. They are the same. That is the correct. The Intel syntax actually shows that in the end we do the same work. Okay. Now I'm gonna switch to. Oh, you have a question, sir.
Sorry, I skipped the question. Why aren't we subtracting each from the memory aspect
of
the table?
Do you mean over here? Oh, so why we're not subtracting 8 here?
Yeah, I guess that's over side of the plan.
We were supposed to do that, and
we're
yeah. So I would like to switch to move forward to the compilation pipeline and to start from the more very beginning. Remember on the first lecture, Charles showed us how a computer consists of the CPU part and the memory part. There is a bridge. There were quite a few questions about how registers and memory, aren't they supposed to be the same? So I just want to point out one more time, registers are little memory circuits inside the CPU, in the CPU implementation. And then they don't really have an address. The register is just something the CPU can immediately access. And the memory, on the other hand, is something that the CPU accesses with addresses, right? Then the register can have either a value like a constant, or it can have that value can be an address. So the value of a register can mean multiple things. Now, how do we use this memory? So this is the next slide. How do we make use of this memory? And the memory address is it can be quite vast, but you know, for this example, let's think it's not that high. It's actually huge, right? A memory address is from 0 to 40 all the way to all apps. That's a lot of gigabytes. And the upper part used by operating system. Then at some point we're gonna have the stack. And you've learned about the stack in a previous class, and you know that the stack grows down so that the top is actually this line at the bottom here, and the top has the smaller addresses, and the stack grows down like that. And in the stack, we have arguments, we have return addresses, registers, local variables, kind of hot data, I would call it. That's the stack. Now, there is unused space for some good reasons, and I think I skipped the heap. Well, in addition to the stack, we have the heap. The heap is where the dynamic memory operations happen. So when we do malloc memory allocation, when we do new, that's where we use the heap. Those objects, their address will always be in the heap. And finally, there is unused space, and then finally we have this part at the bottom, which is writable data, code, and constants, and that is where we load programs. So when you write a C code, and you compile it, and then when you execute, that process, you execute it, takes the binary of the program you just compiled, and it copies it into this address location. And then it just starts executing, so it just starts fetching one by one instructions to the program counter, and that counter increments, and that's how computers work. Questions about this? So, memory space, stack is for variables, heap for dynamic, and then that's where the program goes, the binary will go into this lower part here. But how do we generate the binary? So this is what today's lecture is about. We start by writing some C code, or higher level. Oh, you have a question? Yes.
Yeah, I just had a quick question on this slide. Is there a reason the writable data comes before the code and constants? Like, isn't there a chance the writable data would theoretically write enough that it would extend into the code?
So, why is the writable data, you say before? I kind of see it as after. So I see that the lower addresses have code and constants, and then and then we have the writable data, the binary. More questions? So like I was saying, we write a program. If it's a higher language, it will probably be converted into a representation that's similar to C. And then we compile that, and we've just seen how we compile some C code to assembly, which is the switch and while and previous lecture with if. That gets compiled to assembly, and we've seen how that looks like. And then the assembly, so here's a C file, a hello world, then the assembly code will be assembled into an object. And an object file is something in between, and it's it's very close to machine code, right? An object file is not really something you read, but but we do need them. The question is, why do we need them? And well, finally, the last step is that the object files are linked together. Multiple object files can be linked to create the final binary, the machine code. So why do we need object files? Well, multiple reasons, but one of them, for example, in this code, the function main is part of this code. It will be in the object. But then put string comes from a function we include. We bring it from stdio.h, right? So that is from a different file, and that will be compiled in a separate object file called putstring.all. And in the next slide we're going to talk, well, why don't we just put everything in one file? But in this way, we don't have to generate the object file for puts multiple times. We're much more efficient this way. How do we compile? So in your terminal, those are the commands we run. To compile C to assembly, we do gcc-S. To compile assembly to object, gcc-C. And then to compile object one or more to a binary, to an executable, gcc-O, we specify the file name. I think -O can also be at the other end, doesn't have to be in the beginning. And the output will be our binary. And then we execute. And we don't have to do these things one by one. That's a little bit too tedious. So they can be combined. You could just do gcc-c and give it a C file, so you will do the compile and assembly together, or the second line shows three steps together. But even though you only see one file output, the one that you asked for, either the object, in this case the object, or another one the binary, the other steps were all executed. It's just the files were not generated, but they are all these steps are always executed when we compile. Questions about this? Yeah, this is something you've done before. And let's look a bit through how can we combine or should we combine two object files, two assembly files into So here we have two assembly files, and maybe we should just not use. We could technically do this, right? We combine the two assembly files into a larger assembly file and never do skip the object file. But that's where that problem comes. We would have to generate. So for example, libraries like printf, we would have to generate the machine code multiple times. We'd have to compile it, and compile it again, and repeat the assembly. We would repeat the process of assembling too many times. That would be too slow. And then we're also trying to optimize that and so on. So for big files, for big binaries, this would be too tedious. So by keeping them separate, we're actually managing to be more efficient. And additionally, another challenge is how do we compute these addresses? So ideally we would like to have machine addresses in the end, like that, where main is an address, move string is the string, we know where the data address is, call put string, we know where the address for that method is, that function is. But at first we don't know that, we don't know where they are. So how do we determine? So the idea, or the way we do it now is, keep things separate for a while, or keep things separate. Let's not merge everything, and let's have some temporary values, some question marks. They can be just zeros. So what we had there as move string, we would have some question mark for string. Now translate each. So we'll, in this way, we'll translate each of this assemblies to objects, but without going all the way. Like we won't have the final address, so we're going to have some temporary values there, and we're going to have some instructions to the compiler how to replace those values or which values are not final. So let's see how that's done in an example. That example will make it much more clear. So again, the example, our hello world file, we've seen how that gets assembled into an assembly file. That's also the other presentation. In this case, there are those two instructions, sub 8 and add 8, so subtract and add. And this is really a formality to adhere to the Linux convention that the stack address must be a multiple of 16. I guess taking 8 and adding it back makes the multiple of 16. Yeah, it's a convention. But then the XOR here is actually the return. So the XOR is that return over there. And we have the call put string. And before that, we are going to have, for the string, we're going to have a data location. So we're going to declare, to have this move instruction as well. And additionally, we declare main as a global, and that will make main visible to outside files. So main is being, we can call it from outside. It's a global function. That's what that line means. Further to machine code. So machine code is bytes, right? It's, if you try to see this as ASCII, there will be a lot of non-decodable characters, or characters that don't look nice. We're going to have some text, and the text region is, so the text region here is mostly all these instructions. So what is really happening? We have the subtract, the move, the call, the XOR. So each of them, so something like that, each of them will be doing that. And they are just all one next to each other, dumped into a file. And for the data, similarly, we're gonna have a data region. So this hello.o, this object file, will have a text region and a data region. And this hello world will be in ASCII represented right there. Those are the ASCII values for hello world. Questions so far about what we're doing here? We go from C, assembly, with some formality there that we always raise questions, and then so those sub instructions, and then we are going to each instruction we are representing it with a bunch of with a couple of just hex values. Those hex values are actually the machine code for that instruction, for each of those instructions, and they are just all one next to each other. The same way they are here, one next to each other. That's what's going on. With colors, much more clear. So the green one, sub, we know the RSP, we know the register, we know the constant, so there are no unknowns. So there is no issue there. We can just have all the values final. But then pay attention here. We don't really know where the address of this L string will be. We know it's a data segment. That's what we know in this hello.o. But we don't know the address on the machine, the final address. So for now, this BF will be move RDI. That's what that BF will mean. But we're just going to leave this to zero. So that's what those question marks were in the previous slide. We will leave this temporarily like that, undefined. And we're going to specify this object file in the next section here. So this one we call it relocations. So we have text, that's for the instructions, we have data, that's for the data, and we have relocations. And these relocations are going to tell the compiler how are we to print the values in this hello.all. And the first line here is how to read this relocation. So take zeros at a certain location and replace with address of something. So for example, take zeros at text, so that's our text right there, byte 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, 5, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so that's byte 5 right there. So take that tag, take those zeros and byte 5 and all of those zeros, or not, yeah, and then replace with address of data segment, there is our data segment, byte 0, there is our byte 0. So we are going to replace these zeros here with the address of byte 0 from the data segment. That's what the allocation this line means. And the next one, allocation, take zeros at text over there, byte 10, happens to be this one, and replace with address of putS. And we don't know where the address of putS is right now, but you know, eventually we will know. When we will know, when we will actually start looking at the putS.all. Questions about the locations? Yes.
So for the second line, the 48 in the data segment is replacing all 4 bytes in the, like, the blue shaded area, or just the first?
For the second line, this one?
No, like, I mean the 48 in the data segment.
Yeah. Data segment.
Yeah, is that replacing like all 4 bytes in the shaded area in the text?
Big zeros app. So I read this as big zeros,
yeah.
all starting with byte 5. Big zeros at text byte 5 and replace with address of data segment byte 0. So address of this, of just this byte 0. And the address of this byte 0 will be, you know, not just one hex, will be some number.
So it's the address of the 48, not the value of this.
Yes, it's the address of the 48 on the machine.
And that would take 4 bytes.
According to this file, yes. Yes, Charles. Yeah, and you know, this is all specified in the instruction set architecture. Well, some of these things are specified in the instruction set architecture, such as how wide is the address of the data set. So I don't think we always get 64 bytes, 64 bits, or 8 bytes. But yeah, in this case, it's just, and I think that. Let's just do that. Yes, please. So the question is, do these bytes correspond, or these other ones correspond to a particular instruction?
But more so on like what exactly the purpose of the relocation table at the bottom is.
So we place some zeros here because we just don't know the values. We don't know the values of the machine code, the final values. We don't know them yet. We're trying to go from assembly to object. And this is the first step. We're just going to place some temporary values, some zeros. But we're also going to specify for the next step of the compilation how those values will be replaced. And that's what the allocations do. The allocations, they will specify. We're going to replace these zeros with this format here, accord. So at first, this instruction here, BF, all of it, I'll just start. So that instruction, starting with BF and ending with the last zero, it corresponds with this move L string to RDI, right? And we know RDI, we know move, but we don't know the address, we don't know what will end up to be the address of the L string in the data. We don't know it yet, at this time, at this step. And we put a temporary value. It doesn't have to be zero, it can be random value. But we also specify that value we are going to correct at the next step when we actually calculate all these values. So there's gonna be a step when we calculate all the addresses. We don't know what address that is. It's always an address. Well, in this case, it's always an address.
Okay, so we know the instruction, we don't know the address.
Right? Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We don't know yet the address, but we'll know it soon. When we start partitioning the memory and so on, we're gonna know the address. Starting with BF and ending with the last of the zeros corresponds to that move string to the RDI. We know that we're moving, so we know the instruction. We know where we're moving, the RDI, and that gets encoded in those bits there. We just don't know the address. We don't know what address we're going to move into RDI. So we're moving an address into the RDI, but we don't know which address. We're placing a temporary value for that address with a flag to the compiler, with the allocation flag. That value in the text, so this is the text, right? That value in the text at byte 5, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, will be replaced. We replace that with the address of the data segment at byte 0. So in the end, we're going to achieve what we want. You know, this value will be replaced with this address. So we're going to move string, the L string, into the RDI. So that's our goal, to move this L string into the RDI. We don't know its final address, we're going to know it later. I hope that answers the question. But, approach me if you still want to discuss it. So, in the end, so we don't need to. Oh, and then the last part is that we have one more region. We have a symbol table. So symbol table right here. And there we just specify what is global. So main is global. We did mention that here in the assembly that's global. It's accessible by other files. Other files can use main. So we just specify it in the symbol table. So the object file will have four regions. The text, with the instructions, the data with the data, the allocations, how do we correct those placeholder temporary values we put in there, and then finally the symbols, which objects or what content in this file, in this assembly, in this C is going to be visible outside. So that's the content, and we don't need to put the string global. Even though here, down here, it's at the same level with main, L string is usually local. It's convention for it to be local. Now, finally, why did we not know the addresses? Because we didn't have this other object. and we didn't know what exactly put as is. So without this object file, we don't know what put as is. What is the machine code? What is the object code of that function? What does it even do? You know? And now that we are bringing this file, this object file, you know, from the system or so, it's a library file, right? We can finally determine, okay, put as has this size and this memory, and probably it will fit nicely in our program memory, and you know, this we can start determining. We don't have any more unknowns. We can start determining what the address is going to be. So we start following all these allocations and actually updating the addresses in the machine code. So for the put as, we're gonna end up putting the address of the put as from memory. And then this is going to be the address of our string, and you know, that is going to be the machine code binary executable file. Questions about this? Because there is an exercise out there. Let's go to the exercise. So the exercise is we have int main that calls a function say hello, and the say hello puts hello world, the string hello world. So the question is, which files likely contain the memory address of say hello? So does the assembly file, the memory address, does the assembly contain it, does the object contain it, does the executable contain it, and then combinations of that. So say hello, function there, it has a memory address. At what point do we know it? Yes. Do we need more time, or should we try to answer it? Let's go with a guess. Who thinks A is the answer? Who thinks B is the answer? Who thinks C is the answer? Okay, we have a bit of consensus. D? Or why? D is the answer. E? E and then F? F can also be. all right. So I think my answer is C. I think you know, the fact that B seems to be also a tentative answer, I would like to point out a few things. So say hello includes this method putS that is defined in stdio.h. So we don't know where putS will be in the machine code. Now, maybe because of that, maybe not. But I think that that's one of the reasons why I would say that say hello, we don't know at the object level the address of it. And I did mention, the question does ask for memory address. So this also does seem like to be like an address, but this is an address in the text, like, you know, byte 5 or byte 10. This is an address in the text region. And the question asks for memory address. So definitely C will have it. And alternatively, you know, something else is also an option. Compilers, they can be modified, or different, or weird, and so on. So something else was also an acceptable answer. But, I would go with that. Yeah.
So a program isn't like in memory until it's run from disk, right? So like it's not loaded into memory until you run it. So how does a program know at build time where its like function pointers, for example, are going to be?
Oh.
When it's compiled, if it's not loaded
yeah.
into memory yet.
So that address doesn't have to be like real physical address. It can be address relative for the program.
So wherever the program is loaded into memory.
Yeah, maybe that would be like an offset.
Okay.
Yeah.
And does the OS handle that usually?
I think, yes. Yes, yeah. Yes,
thinking of the future later semester, we'll talk about how the addresses you see in programs are not the real machine addresses.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, go ahead.
So is the memory address of like any of these variables of, like
so I heard two questions. One of them is, will this memory address hold an executable? Well, it will hold that the address to that function, right? Say hello, and that is, you could say that it's an executable. It does have things that run inside. And then in the object file, there was a lot. The second question, the object file addresses, are those physical addresses? Do those addresses actually go
like
into the executable? So, like we saw in the previous example, so have a look here. So, the question is, will the object file never have the addresses, and will it always just be only in the binary? So that's an address, and it's the same address, the first one. You see, so that instruction subtract A. From RST. There is no call, there is no unknown there. So, you know, since we know everything, we're good here. So we have actually a real address in the object right here. I don't know, that's not a physical address, that's a relative address. It's a real address to this problem. So, you know, but then put S, we don't know the address of that because it comes from outside. We don't even know what put S does at this time.
Right,
it's defined somewhere else. Yeah. So we have to stdio library, this object file will have the description of what that does.
So does that mean that whatever is in that assembly file, that memory address will exist in the object file? Something that's visible that we can see?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's
so correct. With list, then like in dot data, when you have like lstdio, is that also, is that memory address
yeah.
But is that basically defining the object file? Is that only going to be executed?
So this address is temporarily set to zero with the replication directory, or visitor can say, hey, that's actually not correct, we have to improve it. But then in the executable, we do correct, we have the right.
So would we say that memory address is not up for that, or like that LSTR, or would we just say it's just an executable?
So it's just an executable.
Memory address, right?
Also for this question, you know, additionally, what it does is it actually does the hello world, which is data, and then we don't know where the data will end up on the machine code. So the whole, I would say that calling this function is, you know, until we fix what's inside the function, I don't think we can just, you know, decide on that address.
Would it matter what's inside that function? Like, doesn't it, are we just looking at where the call is saying hello is, not like where, like, put as hello world is, but again, just like call it?
Yeah, good.
I mean, that's what the question is asking.
Good question. Charles, would you like to answer that?
So, I guess the question to point out here is, like, if you look at the string hello world, like,
right,
the reason we have to throw it in is because we don't know where that number is going to end up. And the same is true of that.
There is one more question, and let's take maybe just 20 seconds for this. So the question is, same code, which files likely contain the ASCII string, the literal ASCII string of hello world? Do we have that in the assembly? Do we have that in the objects? Do we have that in the executable? And all that answers. Who thinks that the ASCII string of hello world will be in the assembly? Who thinks it's A? Who thinks it will be in the object file? Who thinks it will be also in the executable? Anyone? Who thinks B and C? A, B, and C, anyone? So the answer is actually A, B, and C. Look. So if you look here, we have, of course, hello world in the, hello world is present here. This, if you open this file with a text editor, so here it's shown with text size. But if you open this file with a text editor, this will actually be parsed as ASCII. Yeah. It will be the code itself. And then for the machine code, it's the same code, it's the same values. And the reason why this is the case is, you know, why would we do something else? You know, the compiler wants to keep things as efficient as it gets. And the most efficient way to store a string that will later be, you know, decoded from ASCII is to store it as ASCII. So that's why it actually does that. And I did the experiment myself. I ran it. I ran that function. I don't think you really see that well, but you know, this is the assembly, this is the object file, and this is a section of the machine code. So up there we see hello world right there. There is this hello world right here, and there's hello world right there. So you know, you can test it yourself. It's right there. Two more minutes. Let's look a little bit at dynamic linking. So what is dynamic linking? When we load a binary, do we want to have every single instruction that binary will ever run inside it, such as, you know, printf, for example? If we have printf in every single binary at every single location even or so, then our binaries will end up being large. It will take a lot of space on the disk, which is why, you know, another more optimal way is to link programs with machine code that is available in libraries. That's why we have libraries in the operating system. So for example, list, ls.exe, and emacs, those binaries, when we load them, we load the executable file and the libraries into the memory when the application starts. And you can see, so I have two of them here. When you run in Linux the command ldd for ls, you can see all the libraries that are linked to it dynamically and the addresses in memory where they are, physical addresses. And I actually run the same for our say hello, our very simple say hello. So we have libc.so as expected, what we've seen on the slide, and the other two libraries, and those are the physical addresses. Questions about this? Only have 1 minute left. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So the memory is actually
Okay. Yeah.
Like, why is this?
So yeah, just is this your jacket?
That was my
jacket. Yeah, you're totally fine.
Ready?
Yeah, I think so. Go through and edit them a little bit so make it a bit more clear what I was aiming for those days. Let me get logged in here. Wow. But is there anything else I should do on that day?
Probably not.
A Q&A and then like we can see if like we end up like ideally they're getting some sort of like a problem or two.
Yeah.
And then the top work is they just mess like one person from the person with notes.
Yeah.
You know.
Did you see what talked about when I was at the registry?
Yeah. Was that covered by all the letters of rest tech
that I was getting? Yeah, it's like a long time ago, so that was probably
okay, so I'll just have you chat about it. What was the main concern? Got it. So
PDF. JPEG.
Oh,
got it. And then also just people
not. Okay. Did you leave comments for whichever ones if they were missing something?
Yeah, I was.
Or like the word, like even if it was the wrong file text you mentioned. Like you need to submit like,
yeah.
Yeah,
there's one like submit.
Oh, got it. Okay. Well, I'm sure they'll be back. Okay, so you don't think like should do a topic three, like end up being like kind of probably okay with how we've done it.
Yeah. I left my phone here. Recording.
Somebody also else left their phone.
Oh
here.
No, there are two phones.
It is,
I'll take it and
do you want to take it?
Yeah,
and let them know. I assume it's from your class.